Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Stephen. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
And today we're going to talk about, we're going to take our eyes off of our northern environs and look to our neighbors to the south. And boy, there's a lot to talk about there.
Sure.
Our topic today, as we discussed it off mic, was, is the U.S. circling the bowl? And the answer is, okay, yes. Nice talking to you.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up right there. No, it's just, it's amazing to see, you know, when you've lived long enough, you and I were talking about being of a certain age. I mean, you've got a certain sense of history of the United States. And, you know, I clearly remember, you know, I was a youngster during the Vietnam War. And I remember it ending in 1975. I think I was in high school. And, you know, you're always aware, if you're a Canadian, of the United States and what's going on and how it affects you up here in Canada as their next door neighbor. But you get a sense of, you know, American history was always this parade of progress and world leadership and being front and center in sciences and technology. And, you know, the human rights movement, that was a tough time. It continues to be a tough time in the United States, but, you know, there was always a sense of hope, even when, you know, if you lived through the Nixon years or the Reagan years or the Bush years, you still had a sense that America was a force to be reckoned with. And it now just has turned into a punchline internationally. I mean, their international reputation is so far in the toilet. It's going to be hard for them to claw their way back out of the bowl.
Yeah, and I mean, we should clarify that neither one of us is intrinsically anti-American. I mean, I've got
American cousins.
I grew up admiring the United States tremendously, and as I got older, I started to see more and more of the faults and the cracks. But there are aspects of the American character which I've found to be things that we could emulate more here in Canada. More used to be that they were much more open to innovation, used to be that they were much more open to embracing new ideas as far as business ideas and trends and things of that nature. And I've watched it, sadly, I've watched it disintegrate. And it's disintegrating under the weight of its own, the way that it has ignored its problems for decades. Because I think one of the great things we have here in Canada is we're not so invested in Canada being number one. We don't have that attitude that if you're not number one, you're just the first loser. If you're number two and down the, you know, we recognize that we can always do better here in this country. Whereas in the States, it became, if you said anything about the U.S. falling behind or lagging or losing its edge,
or being inadequate in any way,
you were determined to hate America. Yeah. As opposed to being someone who cares so much about your country that you notice areas where it's falling behind and you want it to get better. You want it to improve.
Yeah.
And so that's a recipe for stagnation. Yeah. And that's exactly what happened to the U.S. They stagnated on so many levels and they stagnate. I mean, they used to be world-class education. Now only if you're really wealthy. They used to be behind, you know, pushing the borders of science. And now we've had, this is the second administration in recent memory that is against science. We can go down the list, but on every hallmark of what builds the infrastructure, the social infrastructure and financial infrastructure of a country, they have been falling behind and refusing to acknowledge how far they've fallen behind, even when the evidence is right there in front of them. The test scores for students, the accomplishments of students, the accomplishments of industry, the shrinking of industry, you know, and of course, and we'll get to it, the lapses in civil rights, the civil rights movement that had a huge leap forward in the late 60s, some of it carried into the 70s, and then it just sort of stagnated. And now we've got, you know, the problems are coming home to roost, as Malcolm X once said. And I just look at it, Stephen, and I think, how you mentioned, you were right that in the past we always saw the U.S., there was hope and it was optimism, and there was the thought that they could find, that they'd find their way out of it. I'm unsure as to whether they can truly find their way out of the problems that they've got themselves into, because I don't think they're yet fully cognizant or willing to accept the depth of the problems. The problem isn't Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a symptom. If the U.S. was not in a position where there were so many groups full of grievances and anger, if income hadn't stagnated, if purchasing power hadn't stagnated years ago, and people felt hopeful themselves, the U.S. would never have elected Donald Trump as president. So the people who think we just need to get rid of Trump and things will go back to normal, no, they won't, because the forces that got Trump elected will move into the background, but then again, they'll come forward, you know, they'll surge forward.
Yeah, and he really was sort of the lock on Pandora's box. I mean, once, it, like you said, he is a symptom, but, he gave permission to a whole bunch of disgruntled Americans to feel a certain way, to feel aggrieved about everything from their economic status to their world status to their, everything from their Second Amendment rights to, you talk to white Americans, and they're absolutely convinced that white Americans are among the most persecuted people in the United States, which, is obviously just laughable, or that Christianity is a persecuted religion, when it's dominant in, how many courthouses have got the Ten Commandments nailed up outside, literally nailed up outside of them. It's difficult to pinpoint sort of where it all went wrong, because there's all that hope and optimism of the boom of the 60s, of the early 70s, when human rights were coming to the forefront, when women's rights were starting to be taken seriously, when economic disparity was, it wasn't necessarily being addressed, but it was certainly being recognized. And everyone thought, progress is a linear upward curve. It never goes back. So, every day is going to be better than the day before you. But it turns out if that's not the way it works, because at the same time you had, American ultra-capitalism, really, the capitalism of greed. You remember, remember the movie Wall Street, greed is good. There really was that period in the 80s when, which coincided with the Reagan years and a lot that was going on in the world, the rampant consumerism. And you started seeing the real disparity between the rich and poor in the United States and, poverty that you just cannot believe exists. I mean, if you ever take a vacation in the American South, particularly, or, not just the South, if you're in Detroit or in Atlanta, or in parts of New York, not Manhattan, and you take a wrong turn. If you've rented a car and you take a wrong turn, pretty quickly you're in the wrong neighborhood.
Because that happened to me.
It happened to me in Florida. And I remember being in this area that looked like the third world. It was literally just, tar paper shacks. And the government didn't even bother paving roads or providing any kinds of services.
Apartments with boarded up windows, but people lived there. You could see through the cracks, you could see lights on. This happened to me in Los Angeles. I was young with a friend of mine, and we made the a turn. Oh, Century City, or Century Boulevard, that sounds pretty good, because we had to get gas. Boy, were we wrong, as the sun was going down. And what we saw, and people started walking like towards the car, talking at the car. It was for two middle-class kids from North York, Ontario. It was sure an eye-opener. And, going back to what you were saying, it seems that there's certain groups in the U.S. that they need to be either feel completely in control, or they feel like they're completely persecuted. For example, you've got white people who had hegemony for so long in corridors of power, still do, but they have less than they did before. And there's questioning as to why there aren't more people of color who are very, very capable in those halls of power. And that makes these people who feel that... in their gut, they'll never say, well, some might say it, but most won't. They just have this feeling in their gut that the correct state of things is white people across the board controlling everything. And now that people are questioning why that is the case, they feel besieged. They feel like the natural order of things has been disturbed, and that makes them vulnerable, makes that they feel vulnerable suddenly. And so they feel like they're persecuted when they're not. The flip side of that, though, is that for a long time, there was a tremendous amount of emphasis on the advancement of Black people, advancement of Latinos, especially, you know, in the United States. There were programs put in place to help correct historic imbalances. And at the same time, the average white person's income stagnated. So their purchasing power kept reducing and reducing. And nobody seemed to pay any attention to the fact that purchasing power was reducing, that wages weren't increasing, weren't keeping pace. And though, so there was a lot of people who felt that they themselves were being ignored while these minority groups were being given attention. And in fact, there is some substance to what they were saying. There were a lot of people who were being ignored, not because Black people and Latinos were being given some corrective medicine, but because generally politicians failed them. They failed them in keeping the economy going. The economy became, by politicians, strictly for plutocrats. You know, the U.S. abandoned capitalism in the 80s and sought corporatism, because capitalism requires competition. Yep. And competition means that you also have a workforce that is able to decide where they wish to work. Whatever treats them better, the better quality workers will go to the places that treat them better. That went out the window. And capitalism in the U.S. is sick. It's infected. And only the worst aspects of it seem to be the ones that are surviving and being nurtured by the ultra rich, whereas the rest of America does have a reason to feel like they're falling further and further behind, because in fact they are.
Yeah. Oh, and they're falling behind faster and faster, and the disparity is getting bigger and bigger. And, you know, it's been, I guess, The Simpsons has been on for 30 years now. Oh, and the best character that they have is C. Montgomery Burns, because he represents that kind of capitalism, that ruthless, amoral capitalism that is really the hallmark of what the United States has been for the last 30 years. I mean, and you add to that, not just the natural propensity for rich people to keep all of their money, but the globalization as well, where they move the jobs offshore. And because they can find a market that is cheaper to do it. First it was China, and then China got too expensive, and they started moving out to places like Cambodia and Laos and Thailand and other places where they can still pay people a couple dollars a day and not worry about unions or anything else. In the meantime, American workers aren't working. It's that sort of the capitalism of greed that leads to the disparity, and it really started to accelerate very, very quickly and became a race to the bottom. You know, Canada has, there are governments that have embraced that race to the bottom as well. I mean, they point to things like, well, we can't afford the healthcare because that makes us not competitive with places like Georgia, or we can't have a minimum wage because I think it's 13 American states don't have a minimum wage. And you see this going on in Alberta right now with the UCP government under Kenny. I mean, they're monkeying with minimum wages and employment safety and all kinds of things in order to make them more competitive with crappy jurisdictions. And that's, you know, if that's what makes you competitive, we need to find a new way to be competitive. Because,
or a new way to define it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and generally that has meant a healthy, stable, well-organized, motivated workforce that works with their brains, you know, whether it's in technology or innovation or something else. I mean, those are the things that you really want to be competitive in, because there's a value to that. You know, a strong back is you can find that anywhere in the world. You know, if you go to China, you can buy strong backs for pennies on the dollar. And, you know, because if you're making a lot of money, generally And I worked with a Canadian company that had a project in China for ages. And this, you know, we ran it like a good Canadian company, but mm-hmm. I know of lots of companies that were in China. And if you had a mine disaster or a fire in your factory or whatever, the cost of that was $50 a person. If you killed somebody, you paid $50 to the family of the dead employee, and that was the end of it. That was the cost of doing business. So there's no incentive to have safe factories or safe working conditions or helmets or safety boots. It's just, you know, it just wasn't economic. But human life isn't necessarily, you know, graded based on how economic it is.
Well, and that's the thing is that, I mean, there was a concept, you're old enough to remember it, I'm old enough to remember it. The concept was called the enough, when people felt that they had enough in life as far economically. There wasn't this constant pit of desire to have more, more, more. Everyone wanted to improve themselves somewhat, but there wasn't this, it's like somebody took the governors off. And we know, you know, there's some people who have an affliction where they can eat and eat and eat and never feel full.
Yes.
And I think that's what it's become. And we've got some of that affluenza here in Canada. There's no question that we've adopted that as well. But there used to be the concept of, I'm making this much money, I've got this kind of lifestyle, things are paid for. I'm not worried about where my next meal's coming from. I'm able to put some money away, you know, save for a vacation, save for the kids' college. And I don't have everything, but I have enough. And while I want to continue to improve and get more, it's not a sacrifice everything in your life to get there. And if you don't get there, your life is empty. There were other indicators in your life that indicated that you were doing okay. And somewhere along the line, I think it's really started in the 80s, it became your life is better only when you have more things. Not when you spend more time, you have more time to spend with your family, not when you're enjoying, you know, getting pleasure out of the accomplishments of yourself, your spouse, your children, your, you know, extended family, your good friends, things of that nature. Like all happiness started to center on how much money you made and how many things you could get, how much you could have. And I don't think in the 70s, there was a giant booming business in storage lockers by people who just had too much stuff. Whereas now, every time I turn around, there's a new storage facility somewhere. We all have a lot of stuff. And listen, I do too.
Anyone who's had a storage locker knows that the stuff in there does not make you happy, because all you do is sit around going like, oh, I got to do something with my storage locker full of crap.
Yeah, it's and that concept, that disconnection of personal satisfaction obtained through human markers with friends, family, and so on, that's gone away. And the only way we're told that we can be happy is by acquiring things. And that you take that into the US and you match that with a relative decline in purchasing power, and you've got people who are told that their lives can only be good if they have more things that they can buy, and yet they don't have the money to buy things to make their lives better, so they just feel their lives are empty.
Yeah. Or, you know, the other problem is the debt credit problem, because people are encouraged to, and then this has been going on for ages, but credit has become much easier with low interest rates. And, you know, people are, you know, and the Americans are some of the most indebted people in the world. Canadians traditionally have been slightly better savers, but we're moving in that direction too.
We're pretty bad now, actually. Yeah, we're pretty bad now with our.
Yeah, we're getting that. We're getting a lot worse, and that is, you know, again, kind of indicative of people wanting to maintain a lifestyle, but all of the social economic markers are starting to, you know, they've stagnated for so long, but we're trying to still keep up with the idea of a house and a car and people who want to have a couple of Caribbean vacations and all that because they deserve it, but they can't pay for it. And the banks have been quite happy to lend you credit. I mean, my 18-year-old son the other day, you know, walked into the bank to deposit a check, and they tried to convince him to get a get a credit card and all kinds of other stuff. And it starts that early. And if you're Jeff Bezos and you have, I think Forbes last year said he had about $114 billion, I'm sure he's, you know, well, there was an article that during the COVID and the economic turndown, all of these people, you know, amassed billions upon billions of dollars more, because Amazon obviously has been the lifeline for all kinds of people, whether it was for necessities or just out of boredom. People are buying all kinds of stuff from Amazon. But $114 billion goes a long way. Larry Page and Sergey Brin, between the two of them are worth well over $100 million because of Google. Zuckerberg and Facebook, we've talked about him before. Gates is someone who, he made a ton of money and is actually doing an awful lot with it. His philanthropic stuff is actually pretty amazing. And it isn't just focused on the United States. He does all kinds of world projects. He's taught himself to become an expert in virology too. I mean, he's at the forefront of an awful lot of the research into COVID-19. But the corollary to this pursuit of the dollar and judging everything based on its economic value is another reason the United States is struggling so much these days, because they know, I think most of the smart people know that you can't reopen with COVID-19 going on, because every time they do, there's spikes, people die. And it's just a mess. And there's still this pressure to reopen restaurants and bars and things, because it's the economy. We got it. How many times has Trump said, we got to get open up for the economy. The conservatives are saying that here in Canada as well, that, we've got to open up the economy because the economy is the most important thing in the world. And yeah, people are suffering because, especially in the United States, where they don't have sort of the social supports or the, things like the CERB that we have in Canada, people are really suffering when they are not able to work. But at the same time, as my wife likes to say, you can't have much of a lifestyle if you don't have a life. If COVID kills you, you're not going to be worried about keeping up with the Joneses anymore.
Yeah, the U.S., I think, never truly accepted the sacrifices that need to be made for COVID, and they've not really closed down in too many places, and they opened up too soon because they've basically shrugged their shoulders and said, and people have said this out loud, people are going to die, people always die, but we need to keep our economy going. But they don't recognize that, here in Canada, where there's a lifeline been thrown to businesses and to individuals, when we're able to open up, there will be businesses that are still in existence that can then start generating economic activity. There's people who still have money that can buy things. And so our economy is a bit of a chrysalis state, but once it reopens, the government has given us back our money, our tax money, basically, to keep us alive. And we'll be poised in starter's position to start running again. Whereas the US has been falling apart so badly with COVID, and people are dying, and there's businesses that open and then shut down again because people are so sick. So how are those businesses ever really going to open up again when they found that opening up didn't even get them enough business to make it worth keeping their doors open? That's the thing. If they don't have the sickness under control, businesses are finding that it's not worth it for them to reopen or to stay open. It costs them too much money. It's cheaper to just, you know exactly how much it's costing you when the doors are shut.
Yeah, and this idea of, you mentioned acceptable losses. People are going to die, so we might as well just sort of get on with it and get through it and push our way through. As this sort of idea of reopening the economy, because grandma's going to die, and but we got to get the schools open too, because no one can go back to work while the kids are there. Even though there's no plan. There's no plan for children in schools, particularly aside from sort of hold your breath from 9 a.m. till 3:30 in the afternoon. That's because that's about the best we can do. But that was really early stage capitalism in the United States, if you think about it. I mean, who built the railways? I mean, it was, acceptable losses. How many people are going to die per mile of track that they put down?
Well, they were Chinese.
Yeah, so they didn't matter quite as much, according to the people who are employing them.
Again, they didn't matter at all. They were Chinese workers that were brought in to work on the railroad, and talk about canaries in the coal mine.
Yeah, and the United States, speaking of coal mines, Pennsylvania, that was sort of the philosophy about coal miners, right up until they closed the coal mines, because, it was an incredibly dangerous business, and people died, and they were acceptable losses to the people who ran the coal mines. And the reason that China, I mean, it put into the modern context, the reason China's had its economic miracle more than anything else, I mean, it was capitalism in a hurry. I mean, it was capital projects, and they were building roads at amazing speeds. And we talk about subways, you know, being built at, a kilometer a day of subways. I mean, it takes us like 45 years in Toronto to get a kilometer of subways. But the reason, the way that they are able to accomplish their fast economic miracle, their transition from a backwards, pastoral country to an industrial powerhouse in the world was because they were quite prepared to kill a lot of people in the process, whether it was in construction. I mean, how many times have you opened up the paper and seen a building collapses in China, because it was put up too fast and they cut all the corners. It was all about cutting corners. And the United States, that was the United States of the 1880s. It was cutting all of these corners in order to build America. And it became the mantra again of making money in the last 20 years is cutting corners. It's, making sure things are, get to market faster, whether there's, whether it's the Pinto or anything else, it's like, how do we make a buck on this? And even I'm shocked, and I'm really waiting to see how this works out. I mean, they're doing COVID-19 vaccine trials right now, and they're rushing that out. I'm like, haven't you guys seen Planet of the Apes or Omega Man or or Walking Dead or anything? You don't rush a vaccine. I mean, the science is, you can't rush science. You can throw a lot of resources at it and hope it works out, but you can't cut corners because, you're going to end up in Z Nation, with zombies chasing you around, because if you screw up a vaccine and then you give it to everybody and 4 years later, everyone's got cancer. That's not a good thing either. But but it's cutting these corners because they don't want to be patient and wait for the inevitable to happen, which is, COVID either starts to go away on its own. We built up, we're not. I don't think we're. I'm not a scientist, but I don't think we're going to build up a natural resistance to it any more than we have a cold. I think it's probably going to mutate its way out in a couple of years, and we're just going to have to kind of stumble through it for a while. But there's no cold vaccine. There's just some things that are vaccine, impossible. There's no AIDS vaccine. And we've been working on that for 30 years, but they're not willing to wait. They're not, they're not willing to keep the schools closed. They're not willing to keep the businesses closed, and they're not willing to change their lifestyle at all too. I mean, that's sort of the other side of this, which is, I'm not wearing a mask. It's like the least you could ask anybody, this nation of rugged individualists who will carve a country out of the wilderness, and they will stand up to foreign foes, and they will, fight tyranny, and they're ready to live in a bunker that they've built in their backyard out of a submerged school bus that's full of baked beans and a generator. But you ask them to wear a mask, and it's like, oh no, I'm not wearing a mask. What do you think I am? It's like, you got to do certain things in order to get yourself through. And the United States just keeps proving itself unwilling to do the things that need to be done.
Well, a lot of them believe, because wearing a mask is seen as something you do to stop other people from getting sick. And Americans have developed into a people who do not give a shit about their neighbors. They, in fact, they're afraid of each other. And it's a very sad thing to see, but their social contract between citizens has just, if it was ever better than it is now, I don't know, or if now is just showing that it was always weak, but they just don't seem, too many of them don't care about anyone but themselves. And they see that as peak Americanism. And I mean, Americans carry guns. We've talked about this. They carry guns because they want to protect themselves from, it's not like they know that somebody's out to get them. It's not like, a TV crime drama where they know that they witness something and the criminals are coming to shut them up. They're carrying a gun against some amorphous possible threat. They feel afraid. And who are they afraid of? Other Americans. Americans don't trust each other. They're afraid of each other. And when you don't trust someone, you're afraid of them, you're not going to make a sacrifice to benefit them. You only do it if it benefits you. And they don't see how it benefits them. And so they're not wearing masks. They've got a strange, their country has fallen apart on the inside. It's like a chocolate Easter bunny at this point. It looks nice on the outside, but you get inside and it's just hollow. And when that happens, they start grasping at ephemeral things that make America America, which is freedom. And they don't really understand freedom. They don't understand that freedom implies a responsibility on the person who has the freedom. They just see it as being able to be reckless without consequence. And so they cling to these hollow Americanisms because the center is gone. And, you know, you look at politically, Donald Trump has shown the weaknesses inherent in Democratic electoral politics, because here and, you know, anywhere where we elect our leaders, there is an assumption that that only decent people will be elected. And if people who aren't decent are elected and act in an indecent way, the system will in some way or another, either procedurally or just because the person recognizes they've been caught and they're ashamed, they recognize, oh, you know, I got caught. The penalty for getting caught is I have to quit. We believed this to be true for a long time, but you look in the United States, Donald Trump has thumbed his nose at the rule of law in the United States. He has subverted the rule of law to serve himself personally, not even to serve his party, but to serve him personally. He is clearly temperamentally, morally, intellectually unfit to be the leader of a scout troop, never mind the leader of such a powerful nation. And yet there is nothing that can be done when he does something that other people would have been ashamed of and been forced to resign by social pressure and public pressure. He just doesn't care. And there is nothing in the system that protects against somebody who simply is so immoral that they don't care and that they have no sense of shame. And so we're seeing that weakness that exists in the U.S. When you depend, and any, we haven't seen it here because we haven't had leaders anywhere near that bad, but it's still there that we expect a certain level of decency, and that people, when they violate that level of decency, we expect that they recognize now it's time to leave, but it's not there anymore.
Yeah, and you know, and the closest we came is during the Harper years. You know, a lot of us were incredibly critical of his lack of respect for parliamentary traditions. I'm not going to go into all of those sorts of things. I mean, you can go back through my Twitter feed if you want to.
Well, he was the 2015. The first prime minister found in contempt of parliament.
Yeah, but they gamed the system. I mean, they really, they played with parliamentary committees. They played with votes. They played with structures. They defunded people who were there to provide checks on parliamentary power. And I mean, and again, you know, some of that is still in our system now. Some of it's been restored back, but it depended, you know, they were there basically to game the system. And Trump is the same way, because there are no checks, there are no balances. The Supreme Court, I mean, anything that goes through the courts takes forever, and he knows that. So he does things to the point now where he's testing it to the point where there are, unidentified, camouflaged federal officers grabbing people off the street in Portland and throwing them into vans and disappearing them. And you wonder, like, all the people who say, well, but wearing a mask, that's a real assault on my freedom. It's like, this is right under your nose. I mean, there are police state, and this is the kind of stuff that happens in Chile, or happened in Chile, mm-hmm. These terrible dictatorships who disappeared people. Now, I think, most of the people who disappear into American vans, you hope will reappear at some point. But, the United States, I mean, where do you draw the line? And talking about sort of the caring and the lack of caring that goes on in the United States, I think it's more than that, because there's actually a hostility to caring that has happened, because there are, there's now Republican mayors and governors who have defied Trump. And before Trump started sort of embracing masks, you know, they were trying to legislate that, you know, you had to wear a mask in their jurisdiction, or that you should stay away, that they were going to close the churches because they were a vector for passing on the infection. And Trump was saying, no, you know, you, I'm not going to, I'm going to try to use whatever presidential powers. A lot of it was not constitutional to begin with. He didn't really have the power, but he made a big deal out of countermanding people who were trying to do the right thing. And it's part of this whole idea, you know, there's a macho-ness to it where, helping people or asking for help is weakness. That, you know, changing your mind, you know, whether, you know, you get new evidence that a mask is actually, not, you know, a pretty good barrier, you know, changing your mind is weakness. Admitting that you're wrong is weakness, instead of, you know, it being wisdom. I remember being, you know, when I was a practicing lawyer and a trial lawyer, I remember one of the most powerful things you could say to a judge while you're doing a case and they ask you a tough question and you look at the judge, you go like, you know, I don't know the answer to that. And automatically, you know, you don't see a lot of humility in the courts as a trial lawyer. And as soon as you tell the judge, I don't know the answer to that question, you know, as long as it is a simple question, like, you know, what's your name or your age or kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's something that's genuinely perplexing, to admit that you don't know is incredibly powerful, because all of a sudden it shows humility and it makes people want to help you. Trump is just pathologically incapable of admitting that he's wrong. And he will commit himself. He will double down. He will triple down to wrong things that he has done. Because he just is incapable of admitting that, you know, that's something that he did wasn't right, wasn't the best course.
Yeah.
He won't change his mind. He won't say, you know what? Closest we've seen has been the masks, where he's sort of transitioned. And then he does sort of that 1984 thing. You know, we've always been at war with
Oceania.
Yeah. Oceania. Because he goes like, no, I've always been in favor of masks. It's like, no, you weren't, you big liar. You know,
but he's been doing that.
Oh, he does that about everything. Life. Absolutely.
And certainly during his entire tenure as president, he lies blatantly. The evidence is at your fingertips on Google. You can find ample evidence, scores of it, showing that the man is lying, but he has no shame. He doesn't care that he's caught lying. And we're kind of caught flat-footed, because usually when someone is caught lying, some kind of consequence happens. But with him, absolutely nothing happens. And again, America is stuck on this notion of strength, which is destroying them, because the things you described as being seen as weak, changing your mind, caring about other people, admitting you're wrong, those aren't weak. Those are signs of strength, because each of them is difficult. And strength is doing something that is difficult, not doing something that is easy. And it's easy for some people to say, I don't give a damn about anybody else. It's easy for people to say, I refuse to accept information because it will perhaps make me feel a little bit embarrassed that I had the wrong idea, the wrong information, and I was so strident about it. It's easier to just say, no, I'm not going to change my mind. I'm not going to face that lack of comfort, that sense of discomfort. That's weakness. That's fear. And you're giving in to fear. That is absolutely weakness. And yet what is seen as weak in the United States is in fact what is strength. And so what is seen as strength is actually weakness. And they're worshiping a strength right now, which is digging them further down the hole. Though I will say, I was reading some polls on the weekend and some coverage of polls, and there was one particular poll company that did some investigations, and there was an article that said that quoted a number of polling agencies saying these particular pollsters had never seen such a rapid change in social attitudes as they have the past couple of months with regards to Black Lives Matter and the protests. Even people who are voters who say they lean towards Trump, either the majority or near majority say that they think these protests are for a good reason and that something needs to be addressed, that it's time to address these problems. The pollsters have never seen such a rapid change in people's attitudes with regards to racial justice and the recognizing the injustice that exists and feeling a commitment to make it better. Because, you know, while it's one thing to point out that Donald Trump did win through the Electoral College, he won by something like 80,000 votes or thereabouts over a ribbon of three states, whereas mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton, there was almost 3 million more votes cast for her than for Donald Trump. So there's still lots of people in the United States who hold true to democratic norms and democratic ideals and ideas like empathy. They've just been shouted down by the loud circus coming from the Trump quarters, and the media covers that and gives it strength and validity because they themselves, I mean, before Trump, news services were circling the bowl economically, and Trump has been very, very good for the news business.
Oh yeah, you know, he sells papers, that's for sure. But there was a poll that was actually out just today or yesterday. It was done by Associated Press. The NORC, Center for Public Affairs Research, said that 8 out of 10 Americans, 80% of Americans, feel that America is going the wrong direction right now. And that is a staggering number. 80% for Americans who are so proud about their country, love it or leave it, my country, right or wrong, all that kind of stuff. To say that, you know, that 80% of Americans are saying that it's going the wrong direction. And, you know, and COVID is part of that, but it's also just, it's the response to the Black Lives Matter riots, to Portland, to the children in cages on the Mexican border. I mean, you know, the cozying up to Putin, the continued cozying up to Putin, the war with China, which never seems to go anywhere or ever in the United States' favor. I mean, just the bombast and just the general feel of the way America is going. That is a staggering number for very, very proud people to say, no, we're doing this wrong.
I don't think that it was even that high during the final years of Jimmy Carter's presidency.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. You know, and he's the one who, I think very, very wrongly and unfairly was considered to be just a terrible, terrible president. He got handed a bit of a poison chalice and it was some great spin that everyone did to Jimmy Carter to show, everyone, this is a terrible thing. We need to, elect a strong leader and all the rest. And he was actually just a soft-spoken, thoughtful leader, which doesn't play very well.
I've never been an actual fan of his, I have to admit. People were very, very unhappy at that. I mean, he did inherit an America that was dispirited, America that had been defeated in Vietnam, an America that had endured Watergate. Americans did not feel good about America or themselves. And he did wear that. I understood the popularity of Reagan when he came in because he made Americans feel proud to be who they were again. Even then, when Americans were really, stagflation was going on, I don't think that 80% of them said that they felt the country was going in the wrong direction. And if I'm Donald Trump, well, I can't be. I can't possibly inhabit that cranium. But if I'm one of his advisors and I see 80% of the public thinks the country's going the wrong direction, I'm packing my bags, because that is the kiss of death for a sitting leader, is your population thinking the country's going the wrong direction. Because who do you think they're going to ring that around? It's going to be you.
Yeah. You know, and as every pollster, every political will tell you that people vote out governments. They don't vote in governments. And if it's a question of, whether he deserves a second term, the numbers are just devastating. I mean, like you said, there's been this precipitous drop in his popularity, especially as soon as, Biden, who's far from the ideal candidate. But, the question isn't, is he the perfect candidate the way, was Hillary Clinton the perfect candidate? The question is he better than the alternative? And anyone who says he isn't, even with all of his faults, it's like, have you not been paying attention for the last almost 4 years? The numbers, Trump seems to be in free fall. A lot of it seems to be about COVID and his handling of it. But all the other stuff, I think Americans, except for a very small cadre of true believers, Americans just seem to be tired of the circus that came in with him. I mean, with the all the court cases about all the people who were being convicted of felonies who were closest to him, to the everything from the golfing to the emoluments to his profiteering off of the presidency. I mean, it's people are starting to, even the hardcore ones are starting to turn their backs on them, and it's not surprising that even in some of the states where he did really, really well, especially among older white people, they're among the most among the most hardest hit by COVID, and they're starting to see their friends and their loved ones dying, and it's really, really hard to get away from the political point that makes. It may be the leadership that has or the non-leadership that has taken place overall. This one, a lot of other countries have done better, not just at flattening the curve, but at supporting people through the their economic hardships, to healthcare, to all the rest. A lot of people are starting to say, this really affects me. Now it's about me, and we can't. He is going to kill us, as that old Saturday Night Live skit warned us way back when. It turns out to have been prophetic.
Yeah, it's now the question becomes, do we think that the U.S., we've outlined all the reasons that it's in the state that it's in, do we think that they can climb their way out?
Yeah, and that's a really tough one, because and I never like to count out the Americans, because they always seem to pull a rabbit out of their hat, but the problem is there so much systemic stuff going on there now? I mean, are they so crippled in terms of their economy, their unhappiness with the government itself? I mean, the tensions that have really boiled over, stemming back from the Civil War, the North versus South, the white crackers versus the urban elites of Manhattan. That's really pulling the country apart. And Canada used to be the country that had regional diversity and all these tensions between, at one time it was Quebec and the rest of Canada, and that's kind of settled down for now. And now it's Alberta versus the rest of Canada. I mean, we used to have these regional tensions, but the United States has got this big one, which is which divides the United States. You could the Mason-Dixon line. You can just go straight across. And it is in stark contrast. Can you stitch together a country and make people happy out of all that, at the same time as addressing the problems in the economy and the place of the United States in the world? Because they've torn up all of these, aside from NAFTA too. I mean, they nobody wants to trade with them. No one wants to visit them. They're going to become another hermit kingdom if they are not able to turn this around really quickly. And I don't know if Biden can do that.
Well, I don't know.
Assuming he's the president.
I don't know if they're willing to really, really look at the cracks in the foundation. I'm concerned that, just after George Bush was defeated and Barack Obama took office, Bush wasn't defeated. Bush was finished his term. But when Barack Obama took office, taking power for the Democrats from the Republicans, people thought, oh, okay, everything's better now. And, and race relations are better now because we've got a president who's half black. And they just sort of shrugged and went, okay, problem solved. And it was not solved. And I'm just concerned that when Biden gets elected, and I'm hoping to God that's the case, people are going to think, well, Trump was the problem, not the entire country, and the number of people who supported his cruelty and his ignorance. And they're going to just continue to carry on again with their Mary Poppins like attitude that now everything's okay, now everything's better, when in fact there is so much that a Biden administration would have to fix that was screwed up by Trump. But then there's also things that have been going on for decades that need to be addressed, such as the crumbling of their schools. I mean, that's the foundation of their society right there, is their schools. You want to create a society of well-informed, motivated, optimistic, creative, decent people. You got to start at the school level. and the schools have been falling apart. They have metal detectors in all their, you know, in most of their schools now, is my understanding. Or certainly, if there's one metal detector in a school, it's too many. The kids are going to school in unsafe, in, you know, environments they don't feel safe in. You've got, you see the foundation of America's problem in its schools and in the neglect that has been left to schools. The way they fund their schools is absurd and leads to some schools having money, other schools having no money. It's a pathetic way to educate the next generation for a first world country. I mean, you've got students in poorer countries, in you know, countries in Africa, where
Cuba.
Where students treasure the experience of learning. They wear school uniforms. They respect, they value the importance of education, and they take it seriously. And you, in the United States, you've got you don't have that level of respect for the for school and for education, and you don't have education properly funded, and you've got the haves and the have-nots, and increasingly more have-nots than haves. And that's where they really need to focus. You know, if I was to advise Biden, I'd say, get to work on the schools, because it may not improve the situation immediately now, but you're investing in the future. It's almost a hoary cliche to say children are our future. We invest in children because it's investing in our future, but it's also 100% true. And the only way to really affect change going forward is with students. Because you see, the younger generations are much more liberal, much more inclusive, much more racially sensitive than the older generations. And that's going to change America, but you need more. You need more of those students. You need a proper scholastic system that supports people learning critical thinking, because Americans have abandoned critical thinking in droves, because critical thinking is hard. And they, you know, it's like that, what was the movie, WALL-E, where they were on a spaceship and it was a bunch of people, they were all fat and just sitting in chairs that floated around, and everything was just brought to them. That's where America's headed. And it's time that they, you know, they like you said, they were able to make a country out of wilderness and rock and stone and soil. Well, now they need to use that same pioneering spirit to extract the values that America says it stands for, and strengthen them, and strengthen the foundations and the structures that will allow that country to grow in a positive direction and to recover itself. Because right now, it's a country that has no soul.
No, and the, you know, there are certain things that, you know, when we talk about, you know, is America basically past the tipping point? Can they recover from this? And there are certain things that they have to address that are really holding them back. And, you know, from a Canadian perspective, you know, number one of the biggest ones, healthcare. I mean, you know, what kind of a country, you know, doesn't have some sort of healthcare system? And again, it's tied to economics, it's tied to capitalism and corporatism, because the insurance companies and the HMOs and all the rest, they run the show, and they don't want, you know, they do not want a public health system. But a country that can't look after its citizens, it, you know, has a basic disadvantage. I mean, guns is the other one. I mean, we've seen the Second Amendment people just go nuts, and every other country in the world looks at them like, are you crazy? I mean, between the school shootings and you know, the armed, you know, the armed militias and the people showing up at Walmart to make a statement with three guns tucked in their the belt of their sweatpants, a gun culture is, you know, it's not a civilized culture to begin with. I mean, it has all kinds of issues. There's poverty. You know, we talked about the poverty and the growing disparity in the United States. I mean, a nation that used to be the most, had the best standard of living in the world, is now a country of have-nots. And there's no way out of it, because, as you said, there's no commitment and funding of education. And, you know, if you're in the upper classes, sure, you can go to Harvard. Well, you can graduate from Harvard with a couple $1 million student loan that you have to pay off the rest of your life. But most of the people, they struggle to get through poor schools. with poor, with underpaid teachers and crowded classrooms and no resources. And so you don't have educated citizens who are able to critically think, which was part of the problem, but also they're not able to get a good job in a real economy. And so they're relegated to a life of poverty that they're not going to be able to break that cycle. So, you know, all of those sorts of things are now built into the United States. I mean, you can put the mythology on top of that too, you know, that holds them back, the idea that, you know, it's the greatest country in the world and their freedoms are, you know, are more important than any of their responsibilities, and that they're the rugged individualism, that it's not, they're not part of a community. It's every man for himself, and maybe woman, throw race on top of that too. You know, the reverberations from slavery in the United States and the creation of a semi-permanent underclass, and, you know, and as soon as they start to get a little, a little bit of traction, then you really see, you know, the white nationalists coming out, you know, in defense of white civilization and society, and, you know, coded with law and order and all those other kinds of things. And you see them, you saw Alexandria Cortez.
AOC.
AOC. Yeah. It's easier to say AOC.
Yes.
giving a speech last week about being subjected to denigrating language by a fellow legislator, that's a sign that that they're getting too uppity, and the white people are threatened, and they are going to do everything in their power to make sure the transfer of power doesn't happen to people of color, to women, to people of different ethnic origins or sexual diversity. I mean, there's that real, once you scratch it, that white supremacist thing, which isn't surprising because the United States was founded on the idea of white supremacy. I mean, that's what slavery was all about. It was about you had human cattle who did all the work, in the southern states, and even in the Reconstruction era and through Jim Crow, and we just saw Lewis died this week. I mean, living history, people who remember these things happening.
Yeah, it's America has to be ready to tackle and question its fundamental myths. And I would like to think that the problem is that the people who wish to tackle the fundamental myths of America and re-examine them often are very loud people who really are fairly anti-American, anti-capitalist, anti-American, and are radicals. And so you don't have people who are reasonable saying, okay, we need to look at these founding myths. We need to readjust them. We need to make them for the next 200 years, not the past 200 and almost 50 years. So that's the problem. You don't have a rational middle that is willing to reexamine and look at things about America that are kind of ugly and need to be fixed, because you've got people screaming about the ugliness who are doing it in such an ugly manner that people don't want to associate themselves with that level of, with that part of the conversation.
Yeah. Or there's the very reasonable people who are pointing out those myths as well. But the reasonable people who point out those myths aren't yelling it out. They can be very calm. They can be very reasoned. They can be very erudite and well educated and media savvy. But those people tend to be women, people of color, the people who have been disenfranchised. And they say, look, let me tell you about the American myths. Let me tell you about how tough it is to be a black person. Let me tell you how tough it is to be a woman. Let me tell you how tough it is to be gay or bi or trans or a recent immigrant or a Latino or something. Those are people who are outside of the establishment who are saying, look, the establishment you guys belong to is not great, and here's all the reasons. And they become a lightning rod for racism, sexism, transphobism, whatever. So it's not just the strident people. It's a lot of the highly educated. We're seeing an amazing number of black women mayors in American towns who are who are struggling with their police forces, who are struggling with over Black Lives Matter, struggling with the White House, struggling with their governors, and they are well spoken. They're women in a position of of, you know, sort of lowest rank of government power that you can have as mayors. But, you know, they are very reasonable people and they just become a lightning rod for hate.
Well, I think, and follow me on this, I think that one individual who could make a tremendous difference in guiding the United States down the right path and helping it question some of the things it needs to question.
Oh, please don't say Kanye.
John Stewart.
Okay, John Stewart. Yes.
John Stewart, what he was able to do with The Daily Show and how he was able to make Americans interested in politics and able to understand it through the shorthand of humor, the impact was tremendous. Trevor Noah, fine comedian, nowhere near the impact of John Stewart.
Yeah.
And every time John Stewart raises his voice for something, people pay attention. And I think that he ought to be drafted to return to television in the post-Trump era to try to make sense of the wasteland that's there and bring on voices and so on to have conversations that will help raise the questions, at least, that need to be dealt with and start to deal with the questions that will help point America in the right direction. And I truly think that he has a tremendous amount of potential in his ability to get Americans to listen in ways that political leaders don't.
Yeah, well, it's starting to leak over. I mean, I think he is... Part of the problem is he is still within our bubble. I mean, you and I really think he's clever and think he's not, a smart, insightful man with a powerful message, and he's very thoughtful. And it was a real tragedy when he gave up The Daily Show, because it was clever, thoughtful, truth telling. But for people who aren't like you and me. I'm sure he was subject to all kinds of, you just have to go on Reddit, I'm sure. I'm not even going to try it, but I'm sure they're going to go like, well, his last name is really Leibowitz. It's not Stewart. And he's part of that cabal of people who are trying to tear down America and pointing out all these things instead of talking about how great we are. That's, I think the one saving grace is, I think the bubble you and I live in, which I like to think, of course, is, is reasonable and smart and good looking and tall and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I know.
Okay. Well, maybe not tall, but, sort of that small L liberal, sort of contextually aware group of people, it's getting bigger. In certain way, I think the other side of it is getting louder and more violent. The white nationalists, the people who wear, I don't know if you saw those two idiots last week.
With the swastikas?
Yeah, you read my mind here. We didn't even talk about, yeah. And I'm sitting around wondering, like, so did you just have a couple of swastika flags sitting around the house and you decided to make masks? Where did you get those? Did you get them from Amazon? I'm not sure where you would get one of those. But that's a question for another day.
But what? The violence that we're seeing on the right is an indication that you're right, that, or you're correct, that the small L liberal values are on the rise. I mean, I mentioned the younger generations are much more, live and let live, smaller, much more inclusive and open. I think that what we're seeing in the violence is increasing desperation of a thought pattern, of a lifestyle, if you will, that is fading. That is fading from public acceptance, that is fading in numbers, and they're reacting as caged animals or cornered animals do, is with panic and violence. And I think that the increased violence is actually an indication that they're losing, not that they're winning.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think, unfortunately, it's one of these nexuses of a confluence of events. You've got Trump in power, who wants to ride that because those are his people. And that's that, that's an easy, we have a little bit of that problem with the Canadian conservatives as well. That crazy bigoted, old stock Canadian right, which is, just a gimme for people like Trump or like, the right wing of the Conservative Party. And instead of trying to broaden the base, that they try to fire them up a little bit because, you know, it's fish in a barrel. But also you're hoping that maybe it'll infect other people with the same sort of idea, because that's, you know, those are your people. But I think they are. I think you're right. I think they are threatened. I mean, they're threatened by the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of the world, or they're, you know, the John Stewarts of the world, or, you know, all of those sorts of people. They you know, maybe they feel like this is the last gasp for their ideas. You know, I'm surprised that there are as many of them as there seem to be, because, you know, that kind of stuff was never really discussed in polite society, particularly. You know, that kind of racism was kept firmly behind closed doors. And, you know, Trump and his enablers have made it acceptable to wear a swastika mask in Walmart as a political statement, or to parade with Nazi banners, you know, when you're doing counter protests against Black Lives Matter. That kind of stuff was just unthinkable not that long ago. But, you know, he's given permission to these people.
Well, he's emboldened them, and things that perhaps people knew were not socially allowable in the past, he's made socially allowable.
Mm-hmm. And you hope that, you know, that provokes a reaction on the other side, which is, you know, more people who are, you know, for want of a better word, a little more liberal. You know, I like to just think just a little more reasonable, a little more thoughtful, a little more caring, to say, wait a second, we can't allow this kind of stuff to happen. It's wrong to see people doing this, and to be calling people offensive names in public, or to be riding and hitting them on the head. I think it has, and it really has mobilized a lot of people in Portland. You know, you're seeing the veterans coming out and protesting. I mean, and the veterans generally are not kind of your liberal crowd, if I can, you know, paint with a very broad brush. But you see moms coming out. You see, you know, soccer moms and dads, people who are becoming politically engaged, who were never politically engaged before. They certainly never took to the streets, and they never put their lives on the line, you know, by standing in front of a bunch of people who are just as likely to shoot a rubber bullet at your skull as they are talk to you. You know, peaceful protests, there's no such thing anymore in the United States. Every one of them carries the possibility, a very real possibility, that you're going to get injured. And these people are starting to come out, they're getting mobilized. And I think, well, maybe that is a hopeful sign. It's too bad it took all of this for people to realize how valuable some of these basic human decency values are.
Yeah, it's, you know, we could talk forever about the challenges facing the United States, but I do agree with you that it's never a good idea to bet against them. It's never a good idea to bet against that they can come out of this, that they can rally, that maybe they've learned something during the Trump years, that maybe the left has been a little bit more galvanized into a single, more of a single unit than it has been in the past, where the left is just a patchwork quilt where all the patches are fighting against each other for prominence. I'd like to hope that they can learn that this is a tremendous learning opportunity for them. You know, when Trump was elected, I likened it to somebody I knew who had a heart attack. And when he had the heart attack, he changed his lifestyle. And the heart attack, because he had the heart attack, they discovered a cancer that he had in him, which he wouldn't have possibly had seen that early. And because they found it that early, he was able to be cured. And because of the heart attack, he changed his lifestyle, lost weight, became healthy. So sometimes facing a critical illness can make you reevaluate things and move forward in a more healthy direction. Maybe that's going to happen in the United States, because Trump is the critical illness that's caused them to have to shed a number of illusions. Certainly they're being forced to shed the illusion that they're in a post-racial society. Hopefully that they won't do what I'm concerned about, which is Biden gets elected and everyone goes, oh, okay, everything's normal now.
Yeah, and we don't have to do anything different.
Yeah, we don't have to do anything, because we got rid of Trump, and Trump was the problem. It wasn't my fellow Americans. It was one guy, because somehow he got there on his own. You know,
And I think, you know, maybe Winston Churchill was right when he said that Americans can always be trusted to do the right thing once all other possibilities have been exhausted.
Yeah, and that's probably a good place for us to leave it for this week. And we'll have to keep our eyes open. There's certainly an awful lot that's, I mean,
Well, we're less than 100 days from the election in the United States. So, you know, we know over the last, you know, if you look 100 days back, the world has changed a great deal. So a lot can happen in 100 days, but it's just around the corner.
Yeah, which is hard for me to believe that it's that close, but time flies. And we will continue to keep our eye on the ball and have topics that take a look at these things. So, Stephen, thank you very much, as always.
Always a pleasure.
And Stephen can be found at Stephen Lautens. He spells it with a P-H, L-A-U-T-E-N-E-S. I'm at Stephen J. Kersner. I spell it with a V. Stephen, I spell with a V, not Kersner. That's a Z. You can find us there. And don't forget to dig in to give us some shekels to keep this this programming going, this programming and the other programming on our network. All of it is stuff that we do for you. That's what FU stands for. It's for you, for us. Stuff for the average Canadian, average regular Canadian, who I think is intelligent and wants to learn things and wants to hear things and be part of dialogues and have conversations that are aimed at their level, which is not to say aimed at an unintelligent level, but aimed at a level of people who are not the chattering classes and the media elites who talk in jargon deliberately to lock the rest of us out of understanding and participating in conversations. We're breaking that monopoly. And to do that, we need money to help keep the stuff, keep our equipment running. So, and also we want to grow and get bigger because Canadians deserve media that addresses their needs and speaks to them, not speaks at them. If you want to help us out, you can do that by becoming a patron. You can do it at patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com/FU Network TV, or on PayPal, you can either give a one-time boost or you can have recurring payments. So it's similar to a subscription on Patreon, but through PayPal. And you address that to our email address, which is funetworktv@gmail.com. Stephen, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And thank you guys for listening. This has been Stephen and Stephen here on FUN, the FU Network.